Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
Suburbia and all it promises has become the American dream. But as we enter the 21st century, serious questions are emerging about the sustainability of this way of life. Does the suburban dream have a future?
We're in studio today with the producer and editors and writer for End of Suburbia. We have Barry Silverthorne and we have Greg Green. And you guys just want to say hello for a second?
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Thanks for having us here.
Thanks very much for coming down. We're bringing the End of Suburbia into McMaster University, trying to educate a bunch of young, new, fresh minds about what's going on. I think it's going to be exciting for this city because the city definitely needs to pay attention to things that are in your documentary. And I guess one of the first questions that everybody wants to ask is, why did you do it?
Well, originally I wanted to make a documentary. I just wanted to edit a documentary that questioned the official story of 9/11. And I put the word out that I wanted to do this, and there didn't seem to be anyone who was doing that. So I thought, well, maybe I can produce something on my own. And as I began to research the events around 9/11 and the causes, this issue of peak oil kept coming up. And as I learned more about what peak oil was, it seemed to me that it was actually the story that the documentary needed to be made about. And if people could understand the peak oil issue, then it would give them a better understanding of the events of 9/11.
Greg, do you want to tell us how you linked up with Barry? And were you working with him before, or did you link up just for this project, or what were your thoughts approaching this project?
Barry contacted me in May of 2003 through some mutual friends to shoot the peak oil conference that was happening in Paris, the ASPO conference that's in the documentary. So I didn't know Barry, and I had no idea what peak oil was. And I thought it was, you know, maybe a bit of a conspiracy theory that probably didn't have any foundation in reality.
Quite bluntly, he thought I was nuts.
Yeah, I thought he was a bit loco. But I went, and, you know, after interviewing all the people you see in our film, I was quite shaken. The thing that shook me the most was the fact I had no knowledge of peak oil. I read the paper every day in Toronto, you know, the Globe and Mail or the Toronto Star, sometimes the National Post, and I'd never referenced anything that mentioned a peak in global production of oil. So that shook me, and I think we found a sort of common place where we felt that there had to be a documentary that explored what peak oil was, the implications, and also implicit in our documentary why people haven't heard about it until now.
Now, that is a key question. You were saying that you didn't know anything about it, and you named off some mainstream media sources. And it scared you when you started to realize what it was all about. What were you thinking when you realized that nobody's being told what's going on?
I didn't understand why a piece of news like that, or how a piece of news like that, could simply get glossed over in the media. And the more I reflected on it, the more I guess I have to look at it kind of philosophically, because I think a lot of people in the media and a lot of people, even in regards to your own airport issue here in Hamilton, and I can even set examples in my own family with my father. As you invest in your lifestyle, you invest in the philosophy and the ideology that goes with it. So certain things you see and agree, it's what we call the consensus trance in our documentary, which is something that the author James Howard Kunstler, the new urbanist that we interviewed, says. There's a consensus about what you see and what you don't see. And I think in the media, at least until oil prices started to go up within the last year or so, there was a consensus, and in industry too, and in all aspects of society, not to see the possibility that oil production might peak in the relatively short to medium term. It was easy to believe, you know, what some of the economists and the other experts suggested over and over again was that there wouldn't be any supply problems until, 2030 or 2040. So I think it's kind of like a philosophical or even an ideological paradigm. if I can say that. We see things that we agree to see, and we don't see things that we agree not to see. The other thing in the media is that a lot of people remember scientists and other media personalities getting burned in the 1970s when the two oil shocks sent oil prices so high that I think people were scared. And some of the things that were said in the 1970s and early 1980s didn't come to pass in the intervening 20 years. So I think that people are very afraid to cry wolf, to take a chance like that.
It's interesting you pointed that out, because that's exactly what our council seems to be suffering from. In fact, one of the councillors quoted Jimmy Carter and the freeze on the speed limits, and he said, well, you know, nothing happened. Well, nothing's happening maybe because, as you point out, nothing's being printed by the media for the masses of society to even be aware of it. And you also mentioned that Kessler's got a lot of good sayings, doesn't he? I mean,
the guy is... He's incredible.
And he has a vocabulary of about 2,000 or 3,000 words more than the average person does.
Wow, he just cuts amazing. Like a knife right in there. But this consensus trance, well, I would point that directly back to the media, you know. Or is it fear, which is what I've been encountering? People don't want to hear about it. They're scared to death about it because it means they're going to lose their whole lifestyle.
It's denial.
Yeah, in many ways, it's like the ostrich that sticks its head in the sand. And if it doesn't see a problem, well, you know, there isn't one. And in this part of the world, we've certainly lived through, in my lifetime, through an incredible period of affluence and peace. And I think it's very hard for people to picture any kind of different reality.
Yeah, I think that's. I think he Barry's got hit the nail on the head. We in North America, anybody really less than, you know, 60 years old, has pretty much no clue of what goes on in the rest of the world or our historical context. History teaches us over and over again that change comes. Change can come quite suddenly, and upset people's affluence and plans for a better life. That is history. That's the lesson of history. And I think people really believe they're living in a kind of a post-historical realm in North America. And I think living in sort of suburban sprawl and television and the internet reinforce that. But we're living in history. We're at a moment in history, and we can't separate ourselves from that. And denying that this may be coming, I believe it is coming, but I think it's important to leave that somewhat open-ended. To deny that that's coming is denying that we live at a point in history. But people do that because they just don't have any historical sense. They've never lived through a war, like Barry says. Yeah. They've never lived through a depression. They've never lived through more than a minor upset. And, you know, the great juggernaut of upward mobility and affluence carries on. If you see any of the sci-fi films that are coming out now, it's the same thing. It's all based on this free energy future that we just sail merrily on and build bigger suburbs or bigger megalopolises. Or
that sounds like our city hall. Technology will fix the problem. What are you talking about?
Right.
You've got nothing to worry about. They'll just drill someplace else. And I've heard many politicians say that, just quoting, you know, well, technology saved us before and technology will save us again. But the other point that is very important and that you brought up was the fact that anybody under, say, 50 or 40 really doesn't have a clue. You'd have to live 50 or 60 years to at least imagine that we have only been in a temporary lull in the past 30, 40 years. And this is not how life usually goes on this planet.
Not only have we lost that in our collective consciousness, but we've also lost a lot of the skills that would allow us to weather that storm. The people that were with us in the Depression aren't with us anymore. There are skills that would be valuable to us. I mean, certainly I grew up on a farm, and, you know, I've had the experience of working with animals and plants, but I couldn't milk a cow to save my life now. And who is going to show me, you know, how to do a simple thing like that?
You know, it's important because a lot of the farming has been taken over by the corporations. It's all mega farm. Personally, I don't think that's a good idea. It's caused a lot of health problems, in my opinion. Animal rights activists will stand up and applaud loudly for that.
And in Europe, even your average right-wing person would agree fully. It's not an ideological thing. It's, you know, it's where our culture is at in North America. Like, I can have a conversation with a banker in Paris, you know, a huge Mercedes, and they'll agree with exactly what you said, because it's a culture, at least in France, where some of my family comes from, that sees the value in some of the traditional ways of raising our food. And the way that we do it here in North America, it just astonishes, I think, your average European, Western European.
No, that's a big problem. We're isolated in the new world.
One of the things that I think is the biggest issue we talk about in our documentary. And I'm also speaking about in an upcoming documentary that I'm doing as a follow-up to The End of Suburbia. I think the greatest threat peak oil poses to us is really psychological and even spiritual. And I do that by comparing, you know, North America, suburbia, to other places in the world that have deeper community roots, have deeper family roots. That's what, you know, Jane Jacobs is talking about now, the breakdown of the family and community and the way we've created our lives in North America. And we lose touch with our, again, our historical context, the ebb and flow of life, of tragedy. And this is what James Howard Kunstler talks about. We really have no concept of the tragedy of life in North America. We make it all into some sort of cartoon thing here. It's ridiculous. But in other parts of the world, I think they're going to be dealing with the issues of higher prices and scarcity and all the mischief that makes much better than we do here. And I think we'll deal with it much better than the Americans.
Yeah, I hope you're right. You have to be right, because the whole American attitude, a lot of them, like you said, still have their heads stuck in the sand.
Well, we don't suffer under the same ideological ideas of the American dream, you know, the entitlement of that.
The other reason that may be a spiritual, social, psychological issue, too, is that we needed to be doing preparations for this a long time ago. The technology that could, you know, take up the slack for our loss of oil energy is not going to be in place in time. So my experience after completing the documentary and, you know, following the story along is that right now the biggest thing we can do, I think, is awareness, is informing people around us of what's coming, because it's too late to do anything technically to fix it.
So
right?
Just get prepared, figure out how to get by.
Yeah.
Not, and understand what's happening. Have a sort of clear understanding of events as they unfold, because we can see it. You just open up the business section of any paper now, and if you're informed, then there's a lot of things that wouldn't otherwise make sense. They make sense. The mergers, you know, Chinese acquisition, attempted acquisition of Unocal, all these things, and the tremendous amounts of money that are going around, not to buy or to develop new fields, but just to acquire and to merge with companies that have existing fields. So there's so many signs that there's this huge consolidation that's happening and these shifts in the oil production business and the alternative energy sectors.
I think when people are misinformed and unaware, it can generate a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety. And I think that's going to be our first problem, is just getting everybody in line with this is a permanent problem. And, you know, we've really done it to ourselves. It's not someone else doing it to us.
Well, there's a tremendous amount of information on the web, and a lot of it says exactly the opposite to what your documentary says. It can get really confusing. And I went hunting for about a week, and I tell you, I was scared to death the whole time. I was looking for an article that said, yeah, but we can deal with it. We're doing this, or some oil company would come forward and finally admit, yes, we've been working on this sort of alternative.
Yeah, it's interesting because for the new documentary, which is going to be called Escape from Suburbia, I've had access to people that I wouldn't otherwise without The End of Suburbia. Doors have been opening. We have been in Washington, interviewed the ex-director of the CIA, senior Republicans, who are actually saying the same thing as the progressive. These are Republicans who aren't the neocons. I think they're sort of traditional Republicans that are probably horrified about the takeover of their party by the traditional Republicans. And former ministers of the environment for England, France, Canada, you name it. And that's what they're all saying. Not people in power, but people once removed who are able to see the situation and speak a bit more impartially.
Get to step back a bit.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. They're saying there is really no plan B. And this is coming up to us relatively quickly. We won't know until after the fact. That's how the peak oil works. Production eventually plateaus and begins to decrease, and there's nothing really you can do about it. This is what they're saying, and there's really no solid refutation. Now, I'm looking for that refutation for Escape from Suburbia. I'm going to go to New York in a few weeks, and there's a fellow, Vijay Vasparian. His book's called Power to the People. He sees a peak coming, of course, but not for quite a while, and he sees technology and markets being able to ease the transition. And I think that's important to say in our documentary. He sees a bumpy road, and that's the best. I mean, this is the most optimistic of the intelligent arguments. And what that means is tremendous change and shocks for the consumer.
And if he is right, then that would say to me that the alarmism in documentaries like ours and the people who are speaking in our documentary is justified, because we need to be talking about this now, because we need 20, 30 years to ramp up new technology to replace it. So this is a really good time in history to be having the discussion.
I just recently tuned into a lecture from Richard Hindberg, which is in who is in your documentary. Well, he gave an example about Cuba, and I thought that was excellent because I've long considered Canada to be Cuba, Canada, for 25-30% of the people, with the gap in income, the gap in the poverty rate. And I've gone to Cuba a couple of times, and I wouldn't want to have to go through what they went through. But he said how they changed their lifestyle, how they suffered, but 15 years it took them, and now they're on the way up.
In no small part, thanks to Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, who's helping, you know, subsidize their oil costs. Just as a quick segue, Chavez is an interesting character in the Caribbean, and we're hoping to interview him in the documentary, the new documentary, because as oil production plateaus and prices spiral, the countries that are most affected by this, A, there's the countries most dependent on cheap energy, but there's small island countries that have export economies that are going to be just trashed by higher transport costs and importing of all their energy needs. So what Chavez is proposing within the Caribbean sphere is very interesting, and it's helping Cuba tremendously. We're going to be shooting in Cuba, the new documentary. Cuba is a very interesting sort of cautionary tale. And what's also interesting about Cuba is that it has the peak oil issue they went through when the Soviet Union collapsed. They lost port. 70% of their imported oil was just disappeared overnight. 70%. What that did, in fact, was also shook up the really centralized nature of the revolution over there. It opened markets up in the agricultural sector, so it wasn't all sort of this Stalinist, state-controlled central bureaucracy. You actually had small markets, which make a lot of sense. You had co-ops, which came up, worker-owned co-ops and private farms.
Rooftop gardens and
getting
back to
the land. Yeah, well, the urban agriculture, sure, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Do you have any thoughts on that, Barry, that you wanted to add in here?
Only that a lot of places, you know, like Cuba, will be a good place for us to look at what to do. I think one thing we might be lucky about is that it may not hit North America first. We may see other places dealing with problems around energy first. For example, in Great Britain, probably this winter, we'll see the effect of gas shortages in Great Britain just based on the fact that they're now importing a lot of gas. And last year, there was a cold snap in February in Great Britain, and the word was that if it had actually happened in December, they would have had supply problems with their natural gas before the end of the winter. So that's going to come to Great Britain eventually. So I think, you know, some of these other places in the world will be kind of a good test for us to watch so we know what to expect and what to do, how to react to it.
The list of talking heads you chose for your documentary, you want to just go through the list quickly and maybe make a comment on why you chose those particular people?
You might call a lot of the people in our documentary the kind of usual suspects of the peak oil movement. They've been the real leaders in the mid-90s. Colin Campbell founded the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, ASPO, and he with Jean Laherrere, they both had prominent positions in European oil companies. They were very, very accomplished petroleum geologists. And they published an article on, I think, the 1998 Scientific American on peak oil, and were roundly laughed out of the industry at that point. Matt Simmons in our documentary is a really interesting character. He's the world's biggest oil investment banker out of Houston. He's a big oil banker, and he knows the Bush family, and a lifelong Republican, quite prominent. He's in the Council of Foreign Relations. He was part of the 2001 Energy Task Force. He's a consultant for that. And you won't hear any more progressive or indeed kind of frightening, unsettling voice than his.
Because of his position, basically.
Because of his, yeah,
I'm
position.
Surprised.
You assume that as a Republican, you know, there's this one face to the Republican movement, but that's not true. He's a Republican that trashes deregulation. Going to be in the new documentary, Escape from Superbeat. He's just come out with a book called Twilight in the Desert, which takes on the Saudi Arabian claims, which they're making now, that they can increase production to meet world demand. His point in Twilight in the Desert is that there's five mega fields that have been supplying the lion's share of Saudi oil for the past 50 years. And so they account for something like 15% of world production, 20% of world production, something crazy like that. They've been using these techniques. Most of it's called forced water injection. So they pump seawater and sometimes natural gas into these fields to raise the oil table up. And they've been doing it for so long that the possibility of a pretty sudden or steep production collapse is a really strong possibility. It won't be a gentle sort of peak in Saudi Arabia when it happens. It's going to be a pretty sudden production collapse, and he thinks that may be imminent. So Saudi Arabia pumps out 9.5 million barrels of oil a day, and they say that they can make it up to 10.5. They say could they do 10.5 right away, and they said that five times last year, and they haven't done it. despite the fact that there is no surplus capacity on world markets right now. And there's a desperate need for surplus capacity, so and they haven't done it. But they also say that they can increase production to 12.5 million barrels a day by 2010. Now, he says flatly that that's just patently ridiculous. Once Saudi Arabia peaks, this is Matt Simmons' point, the world categorically peaks in terms of conventional production. Well, Richard Heinberg's in our documentary as well. He's a prolific speaker, author. He's written The Party's Over, which was a real guide for our film. His new book, Power Down. He and a group of others are advocates of what they call relocalization. That's the philosophical background they come from. So, of course, that's what they're going to see as an opportunity in peak oil. But I happen to agree with them as well. They see a sort of returning to more local and you know, hence more sustainable production of goods and services and food locally.
Yeah,
and
back to Main Street, back to the family-owned farm.
Street. Right. Yeah, and you know, step back from the mass transportation and James Howard Kunstler, in his books, calls the 3,000-mile Caesar salad.
Let's talk about James for a second, because he's such a character. How did you come to choose James Kunstler?
I had been interested in new urbanism for some time before even doing the documentary. It's weird how things, you know, that you're interested in life just come together sometimes. And so I had been reading his blog, where he, you know, talked about these issues, and his website, he has a fabulous feature called the Eyesore of the Month, which is, you know, some sort of urban architecture that is just a blight and viciously picks it apart. So I had already been aware of him for some time before the documentary, and I heard an interview on a internet radio station called Global Public Media with Jim, and it seemed to me as I was listening to it that I... You know, being from a television background, I was seeing a lot of images associated with what he was saying. He became kind of the centerpiece for the documentary, from my point of view, because he was the one who was able to link the oil issue with, you know, everyday life. Pretty much half the population of North America lives in some kind of suburban arrangement. So, you know, what he was saying, I thought, was a great way to reach those people who probably needed to hear the message most of all. You know, it's surprising who, you know, will cooperate with you if you just phone them up, you know. I mean, you said yourself that you were surprised to see Matt Simmons in our documentary. Well, you know, it's amazing what a couple of phone calls will do.
I'm surprised to see you in my studio. That's what a conversation and a phone call will do.
Yeah, and you're going to be very surprised by the cast of characters that appear in Escape from Suburbia. It's really incredible, the people that are anxious to talk about this. I'm interviewing Jeff Rubin, the chief economist for CIBC, next week. He's been a really direct and forthright, coming from the economics point of view, which usually is in deep denial about this stuff. But he sees this coming, and he just doesn't see markets responding in a helpful way for people, for consumers, to weather the storm.
Yeah, that's very important. I mean, economists have to pay attention, because if they don't, you know, they're the ones now looking ahead, most likely saying to their bookkeeper or whatever, you know, something's got to change here because we're all going to go into the red. So,
well, I mean, most economists, you know, don't see it. They just don't see it. I think the thing is, and this is what John Ralston Saul, who's Adrian Clarkson's husband and, you know, one of Canada's just best minds, he talks about this. Our professions have become so inward-looking, and they have created these languages of exclusion. Go to a seminar, and a lot of these people, marketing people or whatever, just talk this MBA talk that makes no sense to the average person. It's a dialect, and I think that's what Saul's talking about, is that our society is breaking down into these sort of dialects which relate to what they need to deal with, but not what the public can understand. It's exclusionary. All dialects, like the priesthood or whatever in the past, they've all had these sort of exclusionary ways of talking about what they're doing that other people don't understand. I mean, the Catholic Church was speaking Latin before, and now it's economics, and it's just marketing MBA talk. And he says that diminishes our culture, and people within the professions, economics or investment people. I have to deal with my parents' investment, you know, managers, and they've watched our documentary, and they go, "Wow, that's kind of interesting." Next, they don't see it. They don't see it because they can't. Their worldview doesn't allow for that. And that's reflected in the way that they speak, the way that they think, the way that they're encouraged to see their profession. They're micromanaging so tightly. They lose track of the big picture. I think that's what it boils down to.
Is it because of the way they've been trained, or is it their age group? Like we were saying before, they don't know about a disaster. They haven't seen it.
That's part of it, but I think it's the way they're trained. We're trained to micromanage, and when we're not taught, and this is, again, this is where our role in, you know, the arts or a liberal arts education as part of any sort of business or economics or any kind of background, you've got to be able to see the big picture. And if you don't, or if you can't, then you can't contribute to your society in any meaningful way apart from what you contribute to your profession, which is pretty self-serving.
I guess they've got it a lot. I guess you could say they've got it a lot more difficult than the rest of us because they live within their own customized consensus trance, within the larger consensus trance.
Trance, that's it. The writ large, yeah.
We missed a few people still in your documentary. Who we miss now?
Julian Darley is the founder of the Post Carbon Foundation, and we're he's working very closely with us. They developed the community action guide in our DVDs. He published a book, several books. The newest ones in the last year or two, High Noon for Natural Gas is one, and the book that's just coming out. Is it out yet, Perry? Relocalization? Relocalizing?
This fall.
So it's coming out this fall. It's called Relocalize Now. And he doesn't mince his words about what's going to happen when the world crosses that sort of Rubicon of oil production. And so he works with, you know, folks like Richard Heinberg and the relocalization movement.
Yeah, you mentioned the Rubicon, so that brings us to Mike.
Michael Rupert. What can we say about Michael Rupert? Michael Rupert, in our documentary, could probably be considered kind of the godfather of bringing peak oil issues out into the forefront and relating them to a lot of bigger issues that would open a whole other kettle of worms. I mean, there are six follow-up documentaries just related to those, I'm sure.
He's a very bombastic personality. He's a great storyteller, raconteur. He's sort of, you know, bigger than life. He's very famous for being a former LAPD narcotics officer. In the 70s, he was doing, burial, correct me if I get the story wrong, he was a narc. So he was looking for dealers, and he caught the CIA in South Central LA. And I think he made the connection. He was doing an investigation into CIA drug trafficking and arms trafficking and narcotics, the whole narcotics business that people, you know, hear whispered about. He was doing an investigation. He was roundly denounced and pronounced psychologically unfit, and he was dismissed, despite the fact that he had the highest honors. Spotless record. Spent the last 20 years following what the CIA is doing in the world.
And he's probably the one person who has made the clearest links between peak oil and 9/11, which was where our documentary started. And what my hope was, we could lay out the whole peak oil issue on the table, and then people would be able to connect their own dots. And I think it's much stronger when you can let people do that on their own rather than trying to tell them.
And, you know, this is something I'd like to clearly say to all people who are passionately committed to whatever they're doing, activists out there. People do not respond to getting issues rammed down their throats and told that they're wrong. People are smart enough to make those connections if through a bit of patience.
A lot of patience in some cases.
You know, it's helpful for people to get fuller information and to be able to make their own linkages. And I think people seeing our documentary can make linkages about issues of 9/11 very clearly after that.
The reason I asked you two to come into the studio today is because this happens everywhere. This is a local issue for Hamilton. And, you know, if people look around, they're going to see it's a local issue everywhere they live in Canada. What's peak oil going to do to your community? To your job. I mean, will you have a car to drive? Will you be able to afford to drive to work? These are the kinds of bottom line thoughts that people come away from your documentary freaked out about.
And to tell you the truth, I'm really shocked at the response to it, to our documentary. I'm shocked that so many people have picked it up and said, I want to show this to the people, you know, in my community or my school or at my church, you know. So I think it's great if some of us can, you know, pull together our resources and get these little cottage projects going and actually make it profitable to tell the truth.
Well, thank God for campus radio and independent media, which yes. I am a member of both, and that's the only way I get my news. Oh, I want to thank both these gentlemen for being here, Barry Silverthorne and Greg Green, and they are the joint editors, producer, and writer of End of Suburbia. And if you haven't seen it, watch it on a Saturday night or a Friday night so you've got the weekend to recover before Monday. Thanks very much, gentlemen.
Have a good stiff drink going standby.
Yeah, thanks very much, gentlemen.
Thanks, Maggie.
Thanks, Maggie.
Redefining radio.
Syncfm.